U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Congress sets up a debt ceiling deal and a vote on vaccine mandates as former Georgia Senator David Perdue jumps into his state's race for governor. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, columnists Kim Strassel and Bill McGurn. The U.S. government's borrowing authority is scheduled to run out in the next several weeks. We don't have an exact date. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said it was December 15th last month. There are other analysts who say the real date is somewhere in January. And Republican leader Mitch McConnell has drawn a hard line that Democrats are in charge of both chambers of Congress, so Democrats will have to raise the debt ceiling on their own. Now, Kim, we seem to have an answer of how Congress intends to do that, and it's a bit of a complicated procedural maneuver. So can you walk us through what to expect here?
Yes, and the thing to keep in mind is that the pushback here among Republicans in particular is that they do not want to be seen to have their fingerprints in any way, shape, or form on a debt ceiling increase. And remember the last time we went through this, McConnell had said, we're not helping in any way, and he wanted them to do it via reconciliation, which they would only need 51 votes to do. In the end, they pushed up against the deadline, and 10 Republicans had to vote for a motion to proceed, which is still rankling several members. So the fix they've come up with here is that they have passed in the House a process bill, as it were, that will provide the Senate with a one-time exemption to pass a debt limit increase by a simple majority vote. So it's this sort of two-step in that if this happens, Senate Republicans would vote to move ahead with a process bill that would authorize Democrats to then raise the debt ceiling on their own and, in theory, keep some distance from the actual debt ceiling increase bill.
And from McConnell's standpoint, this is a victory because he gets what he wants. What he wants is a vote with Democrats only that puts a specific number on the debt ceiling that he can use, his candidates can use in the 2022 midterms. And we have a clip of him here making essentially that argument.
I believe we've reached here a solution to the debt ceiling issue that's consistent with Republican views of raising the debt ceiling for this amount at this particular time and allows the Democrats to proudly own it, which they're happy to do.
So, Bill, do you think he's right about that? Do you think this is a procedure that will give Republican candidates what they need in 2022 and, as McConnell says, make Democrats own this debt limit?
Yeah, well, I think you're right about the diagnosis. This is what Senator McConnell wants to do. He wants – look, every time the debt ceiling comes up, you know, it's the party that's out of power in the White House that wants to make the other side own it because it looks like you're voting for more spending, right? So Mitch McConnell's doing this. The trick is some in his caucus are not that pleased with the maneuver to do so. I think McConnell's probably right about his bet that it is a victory, that this is a way to do it. And what he's trying to do is force them to own the consequences of their own decisions and pointing out that they could do this on their own if they want to. You know, normally Republicans get blamed when things are held up. And I think Senator McConnell has kind of pushed the Democrats into an uncomfortable position.
But what these dissenters are saying, Kim, is that Democrats have the tools to actually do this on their own. They could do this through the budget reconciliation process. And their objection, as I understand it, is this procedure, essentially, they need 10 Republicans in the Senate to vote for a way for Democrats to be able to vote to raise the debt ceiling with a simple majority. So it's at arm's length, but the Republicans are still enabling this Democratic vote. And there are Republican senators who are saying, we don't even want to go that far.
Yeah, and you can see their point because it is obviously a little bit of a maneuver, and you can't get around that. They're voting for a bill that allows Democrats to go ahead and do the debt ceiling increase. And it's not the same as having your name on that direct vote, but you are enabling that vote. At the same time, here's the reality. The Democrats, for one reason or another, have been absolutely resolute in their refusal to move ahead with reconciliation. There's a lot of very complicated questions about whether or not you could hive off a distinct reconciliation bill separate from the bigger one they're now working on, use it as a standalone, but that would likely be fairly complex and involve some maneuvers that could take some time, and here we are against the deadline. So they're trying to come up with a solution. Now, I should point out that all indications are is that Democrats are going to have the 10 votes they need among Republicans to get over that line in the end. I think the bigger question is going to be whether or not Mitch McConnell ends up holding a vote where a majority of his own conference ends up voting against this, which is just never a great look for a leader. And, you know, right now, he has in favor, backing him, the minority whip, John Thune, and Senator John Cornyn of Texas. Also, a retiring senator, Roy Blunt, Senator Roger Wicker. And then, you know, we're still waiting to hear where some of the other kind of senior leadership members are, who they are remain undecided, like John Barrasso and Joni Ernst and Rob Portman. I mean, they're going to get there, but I think that the nature of this split says a lot about just how thorny this issue is, and how, while McConnell might call it a victory, it's a little bit more ambiguous than that.
And it is an uncomfortable place to be as the Republican leader, to be taking a vote that most of the people on your caucus, on your side of the aisle, are voting against you on. On the other hand, Bill, I guess I'll take McConnell's side on this. We all know that the debt ceiling is going to be raised one way or another, and reconciliation takes some time, and the closer we get to this deadline, the harder of a spot McConnell is in, because he drew this big red line, and now he's got to find a way out of it. And we don't want to do another one of these. He doesn't want to do another one of these short-term deals just to kick the deadline by a month and get us back in the same place in the middle of January. And to my eye, this is a little bit of a fudge bill, but it does give McConnell what he wanted.
Yeah, it's a lot of a fudge. Look, it's you know, he's making a political maneuver to try to, you know, pin this on the Democrats with the least damage to the Republicans as possible. Some in his conference are not happy about it. I would say it's probably the best of the world that he could deal with. We remember the Democrats are constrained by having only 50 seats in the Senate, but so are the Republicans.
Also this week, Senate Republicans are planning to force a vote on a Congressional Review Act resolution that would overrule President Biden's vaccine mandate on private businesses that have 100 or more employees. Kim, can you give us just an overview of the Congressional Review Act and how this whole process works?
Right. So the Congressional Review Act is a law that allows Congress to overrule recent government rules, as it were. So if an administration puts in place certain regulations or rules or mandates, it provides Congress the opportunity to overrule them, get rid of them with a simple 51 vote majority. So it does not take into account or does not use the filibuster rule. And this is really notable because, you know, most of the time the Congressional Review Act has not been exercised much, because you often end up in situations with split chambers, or where you have one party in the executive office branch and one party in Congress. And so there's no point of trying to overrule. But it was used quite successfully when Republicans ended up taking over the White House and both chambers of Congress after Obama with Donald Trump, because they took a whole bunch of late-breaking Obama rules that had put out, subjected to them to the Congressional Review Act, and got rid of them because because the president didn't veto that. That is one of the problems, though, if they were to use it now on a vaccine mandate, because it looks as though they may have the support to get it through the Senate because of a couple Democrats that are going to vote with Republicans. But all the White House has to do is veto it, and then it would need a lot more senators to override.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from The Wall Street Journal.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of The Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. Kim noted before the break that when Republicans force this vote on this Congressional Review Act resolution to overrule the vaccine mandate, there are at least two Democratic senators who are expected to vote yes. One of them is Joe Manchin, who is the great moderate of our times, apparently. The other is John Tester of Montana. I have a piece of Tester's statement. He says, "I've repeatedly heard concerns from Montana's small business and community leaders about the negative effect the private business vaccine mandate will have on their bottom lines and our state's economy. That's why I intend to join a bipartisan majority of my colleagues in defending Montana jobs and small businesses against these burdensome regulations," unquote. And Bill, that's quite a statement from a member of the president's party.
Yeah, and that's the whole importance of it. Look, this is, as Kim pointed out, even if this managed to get through the House and so forth, it's not likely it would have a veto-proof majority. But and so Joe Biden would veto it. But when you have some Democratic support, if you can pick off some votes, you know, you're causing a little disarray in the president's party, and you're highlighting that there's bipartisan opposition to the mandate. So I think it's designed. I mean, this is the problem. Once you show a little weakness and incompetence, then it kind of piles on. People are looking to take advantage of that and press it further. And, you know, my view is Joe Biden has invited all this by going down the mandate route, which he originally promised he wouldn't. So I think we're going to see more of this. It's more a political gesture than a reality. But I don't think it's good news for the White House to have Democrats publicly dissenting with the president over an important part of his policies.
And it strikes me that it would be a serious political gesture. I mean, I grant that this has no chance of getting over the president's veto. At least I don't think so. On the other hand, if it gets to his desk, even, what a statement that would be from a bipartisan resolution in Congress. And so that raises the question, Kim. If this passes the Senate, it looks like it may. Do you think that in the House, Republicans can pick off a few moderates, and they only need a few? They only need a handful of Democrats to vote yes on this resolution to get it passed and to make Biden sign that veto.
I would wager yes, and here's one reason why. Because a lot of those moderate Democrats you're talking about, I won't quibble with that term in this context, but they are looking for a way at the moment to separate themselves a little bit from the administration. They were under brutal pressure in the last few months to go along with the Build Back Better bill. They tried to put up some objections, but in the end, they were rolled, as they usually are. And that vote is likely to come back and haunt them next year in what is already shaping up to be a tough midterm year for Democrats. So one of the beauties of a vote like this on the vaccine mandate is that they know the president is likely to veto it anyway, but they also know that this is a big issue out there. It's getting a lot of attention because of the number of judges who have also put injunctions on these mandates, saying that they are a violation of various constitutional and statutory provisions. So what's not to like? If you are from a state that is a Republican-leaning state or a swing state, or from a district where you have constituents that are unhappy with your joined-at-the-hip approach, in most cases, to Nancy Pelosi, this is your chance to say, look, I really am my own person, and I'm listening to you, and yes, I'm voting against this mandate.
Finally, on Monday, former Senator David Perdue of Georgia announced that he will challenge Georgia's Republican governor, Brian Kemp, in the gubernatorial primary next year. And recall that Perdue lost a Senate runoff in January. And the person he apparently blames for that is Brian Kemp. And Bill, we have a piece of Perdue's announcement video. Listen to this.
Look, I like Brian. This isn't personal. It's simple. He has failed all of us and cannot win in November. Instead of protecting our elections, he caved to Abrams and cost us two Senate seats, the Senate majority, and gave Joe Biden free rein.
Bill, what do you make of that argument?
Well, I think it's a very selective reading of what happened a year ago. Look, I think it's very much personal. Brian Kemp, I think, is also facing the wrath of Donald Trump, encouraging Perdue to do this. I think that the Trump side, the Trump-backed candidates, would have a better case had Donald Trump actually used his political capital then to ensure that those two senators, Kelly Loeffler and Mr. Perdue, had won. And instead, I think he kind of put in a perfunctory effort, put them in a bad way. I'm not sure the way forward is to relitigate 2020 in the States. I mean, it's a free country. Donald Trump can endorse whomever he pleases. I'm just wondering how appealing that line is going to be this time. And I think looming behind this, I believe that the last time Brian Kemp won, when he defeated Stacey Abrams, it was with 50.2% of the vote. If Georgia gets Governor Stacey Abrams this time, then it really will be a replay of 2020.
Kim, how has Brian Kemp done as governor? And do Republican voters have real complaints on the substance there?
The reality is that absent this voting flap and Donald Trump's complaints about Mr. Kemp and his anger that Mr. Kemp didn't do more in Donald Trump's mind to challenge the election results. If you didn't have that, this guy would be considered a pretty solid GOP incumbent and very ripe for re-election. Even with all the knocks that he has taken by Donald Trump, which really did divide the party. And by the way, that's one of the joke of David Perdue's messaging here is that what really caused the loss of that runoff in January was Donald Trump pushing all of these election allegations, which demoralized GOP voters and caused them not to turn out and vote in that runoff. But, in the aftermath of all of that, Mr. Kemp has actually made some progress in reuniting his party, in particular by signing a Georgia voting reform that shored up ballot integrity, also made it easier to vote. And he's been really pretty solid, too, when it comes to the all-important question of economic progress. The Peach State stayed relatively open during COVID. And right now, the state jobless rate is at a historic low of 3.1%.
Well, my read of the runoffs is the same as Kim's here, which is that Republicans might have won those had Donald Trump gone to the state and said, you guys need to protect my legacy by keeping the Senate Republican. And instead, what he did was he went to the state and he made all of these fraud claims, which did not pan out. And the editorial board covered a lot of that. I mean, they recounted the ballots in Georgia three times. They counted them three times because they recounted them twice, three total. They did a signature analysis of 15,000 random ballot envelopes in Cobb County, which is nearly 10% of the total in that county. And they found essentially two problems. One person accidentally signed the front of the envelope. One person accidentally signed their spouse's envelope. And so where Bill, are the actual charges? I mean, David Perdue is saying we're divided by this and Brian Kemp hasn't protected our elections. But where are the actual problems that he's pointing to? I don't see them.
Yeah, I don't either. Again, it depends on what this campaign's going to be. Is it going to be a campaign about 2020? Because if it is, I think the risks of a Stacey Abrams victory are pretty good, even though I think it's a very Republican state. The Republicans should win. And that's the risk there. I think the risk is out there of Stacey Abrams. And one of the things that should happen in Republican primaries is that you should have you can have a hard-fought primary, but then the candidates come together, you know, and support the winner. And I'm not sure that's going to happen here. Again, go back to 2020. I think a huge miscalculation for former President Trump. If he had gone all out to ensure that there were two more Republicans in the Senate, what a different world we'd be living in today. And he would have a lot more credibility today in using his influence, because he doesn't – what he should be using his influence for is to protect his positive legacy of policies, not fight his personal disagreements, you know, which I think we've just moved past this latter group. So I'm very worried about the risk that this division allows Stacey Abrams to walk in there.
Kim, we'll give you the last word. I mean, do you agree? How big of a problem do you think would a bitter primary fight between these two Republican gubernatorial candidates be? And the Journal's editorial on this today, I think, notes that at least there'll be some money spent on each side. The Republican Governors Association might feel compelled to back the incumbent. And those are dollars that are not being spent elsewhere.
Right. And let's just note that that would also be very unusual. The National Republican Senatorial Committee and its counterpart on the Democratic side are used to challengers to incumbent senators. And they generally have a rule that they back those incumbents, even though sometimes party bases want a different face. But governors, it's very, very rare to have a primary challenge of a sitting and successful GOP or Democrat governor. So the RGA, the Republican Governors Association, is in a little bit of uncharted territory here, but following the general rule would probably feel compelled, as you say, to pour some money into defending Brian Kemp. And that is money that they can't use in the dozens of other races that are going on in a year where the GOP has a real potential to make some big gains, especially as you see these changes in suburban voters who are rejecting a lot of issues with regards to education and soaring crime, and they want to change. So that would be a huge wasted opportunity. But the bigger problem here is that if Donald Trump wades into this race and he makes it a you're for me or against me moment, no matter who wins this primary in the end, Kemp or Perdue, the party will be divided. And this is a state, Georgia, where Democrats have made some real electoral gains in recent years. The demographics have shifted. And Republicans aren't going to have that kind of latitude to just say, oh, well, if we alienated 30% of the party, we'll still win. You know, this is the very fact that this is happening is a very bad sign for the GOP in Georgia.
Thank you, Kim and Bill. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back later this week with another edition of Potomac Watch.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.